brought to you by bedroombattlefield.com. This is the Tabletop Miniature Hobby Podcast. Hello and welcome to the Tabletop Miniature Hobby Podcast. It's Matthew with you here. And on this episode, I'm going to be playing a couple of clips from a recent game that I played with Robert. Been playing a lot of my own rule set just now, Star Squabble / Mace of Spades, depending on whether you're doing the sci-fi or fantasy variation. And it's been a really fun process, as I've talked about on previous episodes. Each time we play the game, there's wee things that come up that I'm maybe changing and tweaking, and that's been getting few and far between more recently. But I actually, after the recent game that you're going to hear, made a couple of more significant changes. So as you may already know, like, this game started out as just basically homebrewing a bit of Song of Blades and Heroes, but there's not much left at all now. From that, I think the only real thing is that it uses three sticks. They're three different size sticks, and combat is a D6 roll off versus each other. But apart from that, there's nothing left basically. So it's been a really fun jumping off point, because I love that game as it is. But I've been able to, I like to think, do some cool stuff, and, you know, stuff that's really suited to the types of games that I've been playing anyway. So before we dive in and hear from a previous version of myself and Robert, I'll just update you on the old painting table here. So I feel like I've been saying this for months now, but I'm just finishing up my 15mm armies. It's taking me a while to get over the finishing line here. So I'm sure I've mentioned this multiple times before. I've got these Goblin Wolf Riders and Orc Archers. Two of those units are basically done. I think the wolves just need their tongues and eyes done. I think that literally is it. The archers are done, and then they're just going to need a coat of varnish. But there's two more of these units, two more exactly the same, that are going to need to be done as well. They're based and primed, but they're still going to need all their paint put on. On top of that, I picked up a box of Stargrave, was it Mercenaries or Scavengers, I think they're called, Scavengers from North Star. This is a really good kit, actually. I was in the market again, you know, for this rule set. I've got four different troop types, so it's elites, elite troops, core troops, but you've got mercenaries or thugs, so that's your kind of lower end guys. And I felt that my miniature collection was kind of lacking for options here. I just wanted a bunch of guys that would fit in well as, you know, either decent level mercs or just total rabble. And this box was absolutely perfect for those needs. So I'm not the biggest fan or user of plastic miniatures. Like, it's not really my idea of fun getting miniatures in sprue form, cutting them all out, cleaning them, gluing them all together. But I did enjoy putting these ones together, I must say. A lot of fun, a lot of good poses and options and different variety. So I highly recommend it, especially for the price you pay for a box like this. Like, the quality is really high, the customization options and that. So now I've got 20 of these guys, and that gives me a lot more flexibility when building warbands for Star Squabble. So I'm cracking on painting those. I actually had a painting tutorial with Josh over at the Crown of Command. So we've been doing them monthly, and I've been really enjoying them. But I'd said to Josh, like, as much as it's been brilliant to spend time on the camera with him watching him paint and being able to pick his brains and ask him questions about what he's doing, I'd said to him, like, would you mind if I was able to set up at my end and do some painting myself? Because what I felt was, you know, I could see Josh doing certain things, and it made so much sense, and I was going away and I just wasn't able to replicate it. So I obviously felt I was doing certain things wrong, and so he was totally up for that, just watching me doing a bit of painting. So I was able to set that up, and I got to work doing one of the coats on these mercs, and straight away Josh noticed a couple of things that were problematic. One of those was that my homemade wet palette was just drenched. It was soaking, so the paint was ultra thin. He noticed a couple of issues with, like, I mean, I've never used the best of brushes, but I was basically using Captain Hook's claw, so he told me to give that a wee trim. Things that make obvious sense, but again, painting's such a solitary endeavour, it can be hard to know what you're doing wrong, you know, and just having somebody, especially somebody at Josh's level, to be able to see and just correct things straight out the gate was hugely helpful. And I was really pleased with how it went, you know, during that session. It's amazing, just a couple of wee pointers here and there. That wasn't the only things we discussed. There was a bit of technique in there as well. And straight away, you're suddenly thinking, look at how that's came away. Like, I'm delighted with that. And I can build on that now. It gives you that wee bit of confidence to go away and do it on your own. So I've really found these sessions highly rewarding. And I'm definitely hoping to do a couple more as well with Josh. So I thoroughly recommend, if you're at any level of your painting journey, checking out what Josh could offer to help with you there. I also I got my copy of Hobgoblin at last. So, you know, there's been a bit of discussion in the community about how this hasn't been the easiest book to find. And I spoke to Mike Hutchinson himself. I dropped him an email. I said, I'm really sorry for asking this. This is like the sort of thing that I should be able to Google, but I'm just really struggling to see how I could get a physical copy. And he'd explained he was pretty frustrated. They'd had some issues, but that seems to be leveling out now. And Mark pointed out to me in the Discord that there was a shop down in Brighton, I'm sure, Dice Saloon. They had the book and the cards available, and I ordered them, and they came like a couple of days later. That was over a weekend as well. So I've got the book and I've got the cards, but the deal was with my wife that that's going to be a Santa present. So I've put that away. I've not had a look at it yet, and I won't for another month and a bit. But I'm happy to wait. Like, that lines up perfectly with getting those remaining couple of units at 15 mil painted up, and then I literally will have two forces ready to go. But of course, I'm going to need to read up on the rules and find out what I'm doing, and you know, start up each of the forces as well. But I hope to get a game with Callum, Dr. Spork, certainly, you know, if not late this year, early next year. I suppose it would have to be early next year now, because I'm not going to have the book until Christmas Day. But aye, something to look forward to, as long as she remembers to give me it this year, because I'd bought myself Rogue Trader the year before, and it wasn't till Boxing Day, I think. I was like, wait a minute, where's my new book? And she'd forgot to wrap it for me. So I'll not be letting her forget that one, and I'm really excited to have a look at it. I've heard a lot of good things about it so far, and being an avid listener to Mike's content, you know, I really admire and respect what he does, his whole ethos. So I've got really high hopes for Hobgoblin. Right then, I think we'll jump into the main content, which is a couple of recordings from myself and Robert playing a game of Star Squabble. So we'll dive into that, and then on the other side, I'm just going to update you on a couple of rules changes and tweaks that I've made to the game since then as well. Last time we played this, you were very kind to sort of help me playtest it, and we found a lot of issues. Things were a bit over the top and silly. Guns were breaking right, left and centre. So we felt that the framework was there, but there was a lot of stuff that needed toned down a wee bit. Would I be right in saying so?
Yeah, I think so, because we were, you know, trying to balance a fun game mechanically with also the fact that it's got to match up in some way with what we're seeing, little guys with guns running around.
So for the listeners' benefit, and just as a wee refresher for you, Robert, each troop type has certain skills or ratings. So they've got a marksmanship rating, that's a modifier to a role, a physique rating as well, competence rating, and a health score, which is the wounds. Let me just talk you through the shooting process now, because that's a big part of this, obviously.
Mm.
So I like to think I've simplified it a bit. So if you want to shoot somebody, you choose your target. If you're within, and bearing in mind we've got three sticks, a 10-inch stick, a 4-inch stick, and a 1-inch stick. Those are the three sticks that we hit each other with. So if you're within long distance, you get a +1 to your marksmanship for the shot. But if you're within medium distance, the opponent is too close to shoot at. And what I'm thinking of there is just, you know, to aim a gun at somebody, not that I've ever aimed a gun at anyone in my life, but if they're very close to you, there might just be a situation where it feels a bit too frantic. So
yeah,
I'm going to have us experiment with that today. And it will just, the aim is that it makes it a bit more tactical, like get close to get an advantage, but don't get too close because, you know, it simulates you'd just be literally so close that they could physically attack you. So we'll try that and see how we go on with it. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely.
So if they're in or near short distance to any potential cover, you pass a competence roll to see if you could make the shot. I've kind of reworked the competence rolls. I had them like they were a kind of copycat of Song of Blades and Heroes, where the lower the rating, the better. I've just switched that around because it's really just matching up our scores. So when you pass a competence roll, you're rolling to see if you could make the shot. So I could go over the competence rolls again later on, but I'll keep us moving now in terms of shooting.
Yeah.
So if you have two activations, so every manager has two activations, you could use the first one to aim, and that gets you an additional plus one to your marksmanship. So if you don't want to move, then you're not wasting an activation. Do you have any friendly models within short distance of your manager who's making the shot? If so, roll an extra dice for each one and choose the best result. So that's the supporting fire. I think we had that the last time, but only certain troop types could do it. Now I've just got that any troop type could do it to try and simplify it. Assuming you've passed the competence roll, if you had to make one, you roll a d6 and you add or subtract any relevant modifiers to your marksmanship rating, and your opponent rolls their d6 and they add or subtract any relevant modifiers to their physique rating. So it's basically just who's scoring the highest there. You've either shot me or you've not.
Right.
If you roll a 6, you automatically wound them unless they too roll a 6. If they roll a 1, you automatically wound them unless you too roll a 1.
Ooh.
If you roll a 6 and they roll a 1, you automatically kill them. If you roll a 1 and they don't, they may return fire immediately, ignoring any partial cover. So I think before we had very over-the-top rules on returning fire. I think it was literally if you failed your shot, they got to shoot back, and it almost punished you for shooting. So
yeah, if 10 people fired at me and they all failed, then I could shoot back 10 times in between my own turns.
So the guy who takes the shot is basically a bit of Swiss cheese at the end.
Aye, like I've got 8 arms with table tennis bats just batting all back to you.
Yeah. So yeah, that's it really. If your overall roll is higher, or you rolled a 6 and they didn't, then you've scored a wound. And if you do successfully make the shot, you move the target short distance in any direction. And that gives you the opportunity to shoot people off of ledges or platforms, or you know, just move them into a less optimal position. If the shooting attack ends in a tie, no wounds are dealt. However, your opponent must still move their miniature short distance in any direction. And that's just that kind of near miss, like, you know, they're a bit rattled.
Yeah, they've deflected it with their armor or whatever, but it still sent them a few steps.
Yeah, got a bit of plaster in their eye or something.
Yeah.
The melee combat, there's a lot of similarities, obviously, to how that pans out in terms of the modified dice rolls against each other. The key difference is that, obviously, they're fighting hand to hand. So that happens between any rival miniatures who are within short distance of one another. The instigator of the combat will get a plus one to their physique. So we're taking marksmanship out of the equation. It's a roll off between the physique scores, the physique ratings. Melee combat always has to end. They always have to disengage at the end of it. That could be because somebody's dead, or it could be that, you know, once the fight happens, the losing miniature needs to be pushed back short distance. So that the aim there is, you know, we've had games in the past where we've ended up with like wee Royal Rumbles and you just can't get out of them.
Yeah, they just keep sticking to each other, clumping.
Yeah, exactly. And I swithered over this because I thought you do still, like, if I've got a warband with lots of low ability guys and you've got an elite small warband, I should still have the opportunity to gang up on you because that's the only real strength that I have.
Mm-hmm.
So although you can't, because combat has to be resolved straight away, I can't engage you with like multiple guys. I could still get an advantage for every non-engaged friendly miniature within medium distance, and I could still defeat you in combat and push you into combat with somebody else. So there's still a way around that. Like if I've got, like I say,
yeah,
I've got a lot of shit, but you know, you've got like a small group of elites, I could still try and overwhelm you by numbers without hopefully getting that big scrum effect.
It just flashed through my mind there that maybe if I had four guys on your one, then maybe you're only engaged with one of them. And if one of the other ones decides to move away, then you don't miraculously manage to get a swipe at him because he's behind you or whatever, and that kind of thing. But that's just adding to the equation at this point.
Yeah, I mean, you could defeat me in combat and push me into combat with somebody else and
keep it going.
Yeah, basically passing me round like a bong at a house party, and I wouldn't get the plus one charge bonus because I'd be being pushed into combat rather than making that decision myself.
Yeah, that would work better, bit easier to follow as well.
One other rule that I want to bring in and try is that dead miniatures won't be removed until the end of the turn. So, you know, in theory, if I had line of sight, I could get the first turn and I could take a shot and kill one of your guys, and then he wouldn't get to activate, obviously, because he'd be dead. But what I'm thinking is he would still get to activate. We know he's going to die at the end of the turn, but he's not just dead immediately. So you're still going to get your turn no matter what. And at the end, you know, they'll effectively be a dying troop, but it won't affect their stats. They'll just be removed at the end of the turn.
And that reflects the real speed of what would be happening, or you know, it's all happening in a few seconds.
Yeah.
As opposed to 20 minutes later, right, do I get my shot now or am I dead?
Talking about this scenario that we're playing, so it's called Bioweapon from my sci-fi skirmish scenarios book. So there's a bomb, a wee suitcase over there, you see it?
Oh, yes.
So whoever is the baddies, it's up to you if you want to go the bad guys or the good guys. The bad guys want the bomb to go off. The good guys want to disarm the bomb. At the end of each turn, the attacking player, the player that wants the bomb to go off, rolls a d6, and the bomb's going to explode on a cumulative roll of 20. So, you know, 5 or 6 turns maybe.
So we each want to get to the case and make enough rolls to succeed.
Well, the bomb counter happens anyway. The player who wants the bomb to explode will be rolling a dice at the end each turn to add to that score.
Right.
The defending player will be trying to disarm the bomb. So the attacking player doesn't necessarily need to be near the bomb at all. He just needs to protect it. When the defending player who's trying to disarm the bomb can get somebody up to it, beside it, within short distance of it, they have to roll a d6. And if they roll a 1, it's the wrong wire, and they've got to roll a d6 and add it to the total of the bomb explosion count, so they could literally explode the bomb, you know, if they're unlucky. On a 2, 3 or 4, nothing happens, or on a 5 or 6, they've disarmed the bomb, and that's it, they've won the game. I've deployed the forces quite interestingly, because like we've got like a cluster of bad guys here, cluster of good guys here. Good guys, they're bad guys. So it's they're split into like two. The forces are divided into two and they're in each corner.
I'm excited to announce the return of the Hero Hammer fanzine issue 4, which is due in March of 2025. If you have never heard of the Hero Hammer fanzine, then please visit herohammer-fanzine.com to download your free copy of the first 3 issues today. And thank you to all the people that have reached out to help contribute to our hobby magazine. Now let's get back to the show.
Thought rather than like, you're away down there, I'm away down there, the bomb's in the middle. And
we spend a few turns just getting near each other.
Yeah, aye, and it just ends up like, there's almost no point in most of the rest of the table. So I thought this might be more interesting.
Yeah, so looking at it, it's kind of a rectangle, landscape-wise, if you like, and there's 4 quadrants, and I'm bottom left, bottom right, you're top left, top right, from my view, with the bomb in the middle, and on my left here, nearest me, I've got my 3, top left, you've got your 3, So those three could be engaged fairly quickly. But on the right-hand side, my three and your three are a bit further apart because it's slightly longer, the map here.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, as you were talking, I was already thinking, especially with the rules you've mentioned about supporting fire, do I want to split these three up at all, or they're already split with the other three down the other side, and so on. And because they're closer, the fact that you get a disadvantage to shoot if somebody manages to close the gap and get close to you, could that be a tactic? Rush in and overpower and that kind of thing. So the mind is a-whirling, and I'm very intrigued. Looking forward to this.
Yeah, one last wee feature, whether we use it or not, I don't know, but there's a wee Whirlpool portal there. So at any point, you can either go into it yourself, or if you had the opportunity, I guess you could push somebody into it if you defeat them in combat or shoot them. So if any miniature goes into the portal, again, it's a d6 roll. So on a roll of a 1, your opponent gets to position the miniature. On a roll of a 2, you would respawn on the top left there. Roll of a 3, top right. Roll of a 4, bottom left. And roll of a 5, bottom right. And on the roll of a 6, you can position them anywhere you want.
Curious.
So, again, whether or not that comes into play at all, I'm not sure. But it's pretty near to the bomb, so it might, you know, it might provide some interesting opportunities. Okay then, Robert, that's a wrap, isn't it? How did you find that?
Yeah, that was a lot of fun, actually. It was interesting to test the new mechanics.
Seems a lot more sensible now, doesn't it?
Yeah, and it flowed pretty well, and we got through that fairly quickly, I would say.
Yeah, I mean, we've got kind of two things to look at, the rules themselves and the scenario. I guess with the rules, like, not too much to say. Like, I was really happy with how it flowed, how they just melted into the background. The only one wee tweak that I am going to make is that I had the add a +1 for every non-engaged friendly model within medium range of your opponent. This is melee combat, and just to make that consistent with shooting, I'm going to swap that to roll extra die and pick the best one. So for example, at the end there, I went and attacked one of your guys in hand-to-hand combat, and you had a couple of pals within medium distance. So rather than you getting that modified roll, you just rolled 3 dice instead. I think that kind of makes it more consistent, doesn't it?
Yeah, definitely. I always feel like getting an extra die to roll means you've got a much stronger advantage, you know, from D&D days, but that didn't seem to be the case. I wasn't outstripping you every single time, even when I was rolling 3 die and you were rolling 1. It wasn't clearly overpowered, let's say.
Yeah, I mean, you used that supporting fire rule to a big advantage. Like, you kept a cluster of pretty well-positioned guys. They had a good view at the bomb.
Yeah.
And I was I started off the game with the aim that, like, maybe I'll go and kill some of your guys. And then I quickly realised, like, let's just throw bodies at this bomb, almost literally, and just try and defuse it. The bomb counter, we rolled for that twice at the end of 2 turns. You rolled a 1 both times.
Yeah.
So it wasn't going to detonate anytime soon. But then my guy managed to... he was dying. He was literally dying. As I said at the start, we weren't removing casualties till the end of the turn. So you had scored a fatal hit on this guy, and he rolled a 5 to defuse the bomb just before he dropped dead. So what a hero.
Yeah, classic Hollywood, you know, the guy that's dying and he throws the dagger just before he collapses.
Yeah. I mean, the scenario is good. It's good to have these wee scenarios where there's something else going on. But we did kind of say at the time, it just felt a bit abrupt. Like, I rolled the 5 and went, oh. And
that was it.
It was like an anti-climax almost. So there maybe is a way to make sure that it's not just like, remember, and it was one of the World Cups, and they introduced the golden goal.
Yeah.
And it was like an extra time. And I mean, the concept was good. It was like, well, score the goal, you've won the game.
Yeah.
But it just, it didn't really work. And it
anticlimactic.
Yeah.
Ability to respond. Then you change it to silver goal, that if you were winning at half time.
That was even worse.
Yeah.
So, aye. It's difficult. It's difficult having these victory conditions. You maybe have to have, you know, maybe you have this as one part of the scenario, and then there's another thing going on, and it gives you the chance to, okay, you've scored massive amounts of points for defusing the bomb, but there's still this other angle going on. I could still go over here and do this thing. And maybe if you have three different objectives once.
Or maybe I can restart the bomb within a turn or two turns or whatever.
Yeah.
And so it isn't just about me killing all your guys to let the bomb go off, and not about you killing all my guys without bothering to stop the bomb, or something a little bit extra. But, you know, or maybe it's just a six that you have to roll on in order to get it to be disarmed immediately.
Yeah.
So some mechanic that just extends it a tiny bit, like you've got to sit on the bomb, disarm it, but stay with it for a turn or something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, there's lots more scenarios in that book to try out. I was thinking for the next game as well, we could return to the fantasy worlds. I was thinking of dusting down Grob and Harold and getting the band back together. So we could see how the fantasy variation works, which is pretty much the same rules, but obviously there'll be a wee bit less shooting going on. You've still got your crossbows and that, but
yeah,
we'll be able to give more a spin to the sort of melee way of doing, and there'll be a bit of magic in there too. So
yeah, and even with this, you might have to play it out 10 times, and if the good guys disarm the bomb every time, then that will show you, like, maybe I was just unlucky that time killing your guy, but he still managed to get it disarmed. You maybe need to play it through consistently enough to see, right, well, that needs to be balanced or whatever. So it's not a bad problem to have. Oh no, I have to play this game multiple times. Go on then.
Yeah, I did like, I definitely liked not removing casualties till the end of the turn as well, because it gives that cinematic moments. And again, it's a total anticlimax if at the very start of a turn you lose one of your troopers. You know, you've basically lost a turn. Whereas it's like, okay, I could accept that he's going to die, but let's see, you know, can he get a shot in? Can he still do something before he drops dead? So
yeah, and that's fair, because the draw is random who goes first or whatnot.
Mm-hmm. It's a single deck of cards randomized. So
as opposed to D&D, where depending on what kind of character you've got, that can help give you a modifier to how quickly you start. You'll call initiative and you roll a die and add your modifier, so a quicker character would be more likely to go first and all that. But so yeah, if they get the hit in quick, fine, because they're a quicker character, but that's not really the case with these guys. It is random, so that does balance it out for sure.
Well, thanks again for the game. We'll catch up on the podcast on our next one.
Yeah, my pleasure. I've had a great time.
Big thanks to Robert for joining me for that game, and we're hoping to get another one arranged very soon. And I've been working away on the rules since then as well, so there's been a few little changes. I added in jumping and climbing rules. So I brought in an agility stat for that. I was trying to find a way around not bringing in another stat, but this made sense in the end. So I've got agility in there now. And to climb, it's a unmodified rule of a 5, but you could deduct your agility from that to successfully climb something. So if you've got an agility of 2, you'd need to roll a 3 to climb something, basically. And we use stick sizes to determine, you know, how many dice you'd maybe need to roll, for example. Jumping as well, jumping a wee bit easier at 4, and again, you just deduct your agility from that. So if you've got an agility of 1, you would roll a 3 to jump. And again, that's you're using the stick length as well. The medium stick is the sort of generic benchmark there for jumping and climbing distances. But I really like being able to bring these rules in. What I found is my terrain collection has a lot of great ledges and platforms, and just no real way for miniatures to get to them, because I don't actually have like any stairs or ladders or, you know, anything like that. So I thought, you know, we could bring literally a whole new dimension to a tabletop if we implement these jumping and climbing rules as well. So that, you know, I've not done a massive amount of testing with these yet, but it's a pretty straightforward system, and I don't really anticipate any problems with it. Competence was a stat. I've changed that to alertness. This is kind of just minutiae. But yeah, the alertness rolls, that's a little test you maybe have to take to shoot at somebody or be shot at. And it's kind of, it pertains to a miniature being in partial cover. Like if it's a bit dubious, or, you know, if a miniature, if your target is within short distance of cover, you both have an alertness stat, and there's a roll off that happens here to just see if you could make the shot or not. Supporting fire, I've just reverted that to core and elite troops as well. I didn't really want the mercs and the thugs to be able to participate in that, because you could just end up with, like, you could really overpower that with low points value troops. So supporting fire, if you've got a core trooper and an elite, or two elites or two core troopers, you could provide supporting fire, and you could roll an extra dice when you're shooting. So that was a little correction that I'd made as well. I turned physique into toughness, and the reason for that was bringing in this agility stat. Like before, physique was just, I mean, literally your physique, you know, your toughness, your agility, and everything was all encompassed in there. But now that's become toughness, so that comes into play with melee combat, and also to see how you handle taking a bullet as well. So we've got toughness stat in there. What's kind of a wee quirk of that is, for example, like if you've got gene stealers or xenomorphs or that, you want their toughness to be high in terms of like how they could physically attack you, but you don't want it to be high that they're really hard to shoot and take down as well. Like with that kind of swarm, the idea with that thematically is that, you know, there's a lot of them coming at you. They should be pretty easy to shoot and kill, but once they get to you, they should be really terrifying in hand-to-hand combat, and that's when they could do a lot of damage. So how I've kind of worked around that is I've kept their toughness low, but I've given them a bonus for initiating hand-to-hand combat. So again, like I'm saying, they'll be pretty easy to take down if they're coming at you, but if they get to you, they're going to get a lot of modifiers and bonuses that are going to make them pretty impossible to deal with once you go toe-to-toe with them. So I've also brought in rules for wizards and Mace of Spades and the fantasy variation. And the kind of thought process here was I didn't want to have a wizard in a warband that was trying to get spells away and nothing was happening. Like the spells were just failing. So what I decided to do instead, you've got two activations per miniature in Mace of Spades and in Star Squabble. So the idea here is that when the wizard wants to activate, they could roll 1d6 or 2d6. And basically that is that's the outcome of their spell. There's a table here, 1 to 12. Obviously, you'll only get the 1 if you're rolling a d6, if you're just taking one activation. But 12 outcomes there, ranging from, you know, a couple of bad things happening in the lower numbers and a few decent things happening on your average numbers, and then your high numbers, you get pretty powerful things happening as well. And you could tie that up, you know, if you've got your own Jeff, the Wandering Wizard, which we've talked about in a previous episode, you could tie that in with his own unique spell malfunction table. You could replace the options, you know, the roll of a 1 or a 2 for something to happen to Jeff if you want to take him in your warband as well. So, yeah, if you want to activate your wizard, you're basically rolling 1d6 or 2d6, and that'll just tell you what's happened with the spell. So something always happens. It might not always be good. It might be a bit chaotic and you could benefit from it, but likewise, so could your opponent. And, you know, if you roll certain numbers, you're going to get some pretty powerful attacks or opportunities in your favour. So that is magic users in Mace of Spades. And then another little thing I've created to add some flavour as well was this kind of vendetta mechanic, which is something that you could do when you've got your forces lined up on the table. Basically, you're about to play a game, you've got a scenario, but just to add this extra little bit of spice, there's a table that you could roll on here. So before the start of the game, you randomly draw a character from each warband. The first one to be selected has a vendetta against the second one because, and then you roll on a d6. So if you roll a 1, they made an obscene gesture to them and insulted their mother. On a roll of a 2, they have a price on their head and it doesn't need to come attached to their shoulders. On a 3, they once stole something precious from them. A 4, they once held them captive and tortured them for information. A 5, they once defeated and maimed them in a previous battle. And a 6, they killed their mentor. So if it's a 2, 3, 4 or 5, it increases the wronged party's toughness by +1 against that one opponent. A 6 increases their toughness by +2 against them. A 1 decreases their toughness by -1 though, as they've become recklessly wound up by that insult. So again, you could adapt that, you know, if that's of interest to you. You could adapt that to your own rule system as well, you know, in relation to what benefits or negative modifiers you're going to assign to either character. But I just like that thought. You know, we've got these two characters on the table that there's a bit of a problem between them, and it could be a bit of a showcase fight as well. You could even bring in a rule or a gentleman's agreement that these characters will be allowed to have a duel in the middle of the table and nobody else is going to try and shoot at them. Or you could, you know, help your guy out and try and take them down before they get to them. So it's totally up to you. It's just another extra wee opportunity for a bit of narrative storytelling. All right then, a bit of housekeeping. In the Discord community, Mark and David have organised the next Royal Orc Tavern get together. This is the Christmas session. It's Monday the 16th of December, and that's 7 p.m. to 9 p.m. UK time. So I'll let you do the conversion for your own particular corner of the world. But on that session as well, the aim is that we will have our Santa Night Fever Secret Santa done and dusted by then, and there might be the opportunity for some folks to open up their wee presents live on air if you like. So that actually brings me to mention as well, like I'm saying, Santa Night Fever, the Secret Santa, you'll find the way to get involved in that if you go to bedroombattlefields.com/discord. I'm going to leave that open maybe for another week or so. Time of recording just now, we are the 14th of November. So before the end of November, I'm going to close this up and make sure I could pair everyone up as well. So that's the Secret Santa, which you'll find in the Discord. And then we also have the question of the month. As always, the question of the month for November 2024 is, what's your relationship with miniature painting? Is it the main aspect of your hobby and something that you strive for mastery or recognition in? Is it something you enjoy and find relaxing without worrying about perfectionism? Or is it something you'd rather not do at all, but you see it as a means to an end? So please submit your answers in audio form by going to bedroombattlefields.com/voicemail. You'll find the little audio recorder there. I need them in by Friday the 29th of November if you want to take part in December's episode. So that link again is bedroombattlefields.com/voicemail. All right, I think that is just about it for this episode of the Tabletop Miniature Hobby Podcast. Thanks, as always, for listening. I really do appreciate your time, and we'll catch up again on the next one.